relegating it to transoceanic flights. Few routes and high ticket prices meant the jet was unprofitable and thus taken out of service. A sonic boom happens when an object exceeds the speed of sound, about 700 miles an hour, depending on air temperature. It pushes sound pressure waves in front of it so fast that they collide with each other, eventually fusing into a single shock wave that we hear as a loud noise. Bullets and bullwhips move fast enough to make small sonic booms. Lightning heats the air so fast that it expands faster than the speed of sound, which we hear as thunder. New supersonic jets, now in development, are shaped so that the boom doesn't reach the ground, creating a smaller effect that its designers call a sonic thump. More research in these areas could see a boom in supersonic air travel in the future. I'm Scott Tinker.
EarthDate is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from EarthX, bringing people together to build a sustainable future at earthx.org. And you can hear more EarthDate stories at earthdate.org.
Welcome to tonight's installment of the Regional Roundup. I'm Chris. We invite you to join us for the next hour as we feature the top national, state, and local stories making headlines today.
From the Chris Broadcast Center in Windsor, here is tonight's Regional Roundup.
Hello, it is April 18th. I'm Lodi Evola, and I'll be reading to you today from the front pages of the New York Times and the Hartford Courant. We'll take a look before we begin our stories at the photographs on the front of both newspapers. On the front of the New York Times, the large colored main photograph, probably about a 5x7, is of deadly flooding. It's in the Middle East, this particular photograph of the United Arab Emirates, and it's in front of what appears to be a public building with men walking almost knee-deep in water. They had incredible flooding in one day, more rain than they usually get in a year, and they're just not situated to handle it. The next photograph is probably a 2x2, a small colored photograph. It's the seven Revolutionary Guards that were killed in Iran. And it shows coffins lying end to end, covered with the Iranian, each one covered with the Iranian flag, and featuring a photograph of the dead guards, and overlooking many men, dozens of men, all with their heads bowed, some bareheaded, some with turban-style headwear. And this, as I said, is at the funeral for these men. We will have a story about that. And the last photograph on the Times shows a fighter with some piece of military hardware over his shoulder in the woods. Trees have no leaves on them, very stark, all in sepia tones. And this has to do with foreign fighters who've signed up to help Ukraine. And this must be a photograph of one of them. And then on the front of the Hartford Courant, a photograph, probably a 2x2, of Ellen Ash Peters, who was the Chief Justice of the Connecticut Supreme Court. She has died, and there will be a story about her when we get to the Current. The largest photograph, again about a 5x7 colored photograph, shows restaurant workers being trained in how to deal with sexual harassment. This shows an instructor. This happens to be in Glastonbury, a male instructor coming up behind a woman and his student, and she's showing how to counteract certain movements. And then the last picture on the Current, and we will have that story, shows House Speaker Mike Johnson, who's a Republican from Louisiana. He's banging down his gavel at a joint meeting of Congress. The American flag is behind him. So with that, we will go to our top story on the New York Times front page. How Israel's miscalculation poked at a hornet's nest. Israel was mere moments away from an airstrike on April 1st that killed several senior Iranian commanders at Iran's embassy complex in Syria when it told the United States what was about to happen. Israel's closest ally had just been caught off guard. Aides quickly alerted Jake Sullivan, President Biden's national security advisor, John Finer, the deputy national security advisor, Brett McGurk, Mr. Biden's Middle East coordinator, and others who saw that the strike could have serious consequences, a U.S. official said. Publicly, U.S. officials voiced support for Israel, but privately they expressed anger that it would take such aggressive action against Iran without consulting Washington. The Israelis had badly miscalculated, thinking that Iran would not react strongly, according to multiple American officials who were involved in high-level discussions after the attack, a view shared by a senior Israeli official. On Saturday, Iran launched a retaliatory barrage of more than 300 drones and missiles at Israel, an unexpectedly large-scale response, if one that did minimal damage. The events made clear that the unwritten rules of engagement in the long simmering conflict between Israel and Iran have changed drastically in recent months, making it harder than ever for each side to gauge the other's intentions and reactions. Since the October 7 attack on Israel by Hamas, an Iranian ally, and Israel's subsequent bombardment of the Gaza Strip, there has been escalation after escalation and miscalculation after miscalculation, raising fears of a retribution cycle that could potentially become an all-out war. Even after it became clear that Iran would retaliate, U.S. and Israeli officials initially thought the scale of the response would be fairly limited, before scrambling to revise their assessment again and again. Now the focus is on what Israel will do next and how Iran might respond. We are in a situation where basically everybody can claim victory, said Ali Vaez, the Iran director of the International Crisis Group. Iran can say that it took revenge. Israel can say it defeated the Iranian attack. And the United States can say it successfully deterred Iran and defended Israel. But, Mr. Vaez said, if we get into another round of tit-for-tat, it can easily spiral out of control, not just for Iran and Israel, but for the rest of the region and the entire world. This account of these tense weeks is gleaned from interviews with U.S. officials, as well as officials from Israel, Iran, and other Middle Eastern states. All of them spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss sensitive matters they were not publicly authorized to reveal. Senate rejects push for trial of Mayorkas. The Senate on Wednesday dismissed the impeachment case against Alejandro N. Mayorkas, the Homeland Security Secretary, voting along party lines before his trial got underway to sweep aside two charges accusing him of failing to enforce immigration laws and breaching the public trust. By a vote of 51-48, with one senator voting present, the Senate ruled that the first charge was unconstitutional because it failed to meet the constitutional bar of a high crime or misdemeanor. Republicans united in opposition, except for Senator Lisa Murkowski of Alaska, the lone present vote, while Democrats were unanimously in favor. Mr. Murkowski joined her party in voting against dismissal of the second count on the same grounds. It fell along party lines on a 51-49 vote. Senator Chuck Schumer, Democrat of New York and the majority leader, moved to dismiss each charge, arguing that a cabinet member cannot be impeached and removed merely for carrying out the policies of the administration he serves. To validate this gross abuse by the House would be a grave mistake and could set a dangerous precedent for the future, Mr. Schumer said. It took only about 3 hours for the Senate to dispense with the matter. Republicans, for their part, warned that the dangerous precedent was the one that Democrats set by moving to skip an impeachment trial altogether, which they argued was a shirking of the Senate's constitutional duty. They tried several times to delay the dismissal, failing on a series of party-line votes. Tabling articles of impeachment would be unprecedented in the history of the Senate. It's as simple as that, said Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, the minority leader. Mr. McConnell did not mention that he voted in favor of an unsuccessful Republican effort in 2021 to dismiss a second impeachment case against former President Donald J. Trump over the January 6th attack on the Capitol before the Senate held a trial. Republican senators were outraged at Mr. Schumer's maneuvering. Some accused him of degrading the institution of the Senate and the Constitution itself. Others beat their desks as they called for a delay of the trial for 2 weeks until next month or even until after the November election. They accused Mr. Mayorkas of lying to Congress and impeding Republican investigations. Senator Mike Lee of Utah, visibly frustrated, rushed around the chamber trying to strategize with his fellow Republicans. Columbia Chief vows remedies to anti-Semitism. The president of Columbia said the university had suspended 15 students. She promised that one visiting professor will never work at Columbia again, that last in quotes. And when she was grilled over whether she would remove another professor from his leadership position, she appeared to make a decision right there on Capitol Hill. I think I would, yes. The president, Namat Shafik, disclosed the disciplinary details, which are usually confidential, as part of an all-out effort on Wednesday to persuade a House committee investigating Columbia that she was taking serious action to combat a wave of anti-Semitism following the Israel-Hamas war. In nearly 4 hours of testimony before the Republican-led Committee on Education and the Workforce, Dr. Shafik conceded that Columbia had initially been overwhelmed by an outbreak of campus protests. But she said its leaders now agreed that some had used anti-Semitic language and that certain contested phrases, like from the river to the sea, might warrant discipline. I promise you, from the messages I'm hearing from students, they are getting the message that violations of our policy will have consequences, Dr. Shafik said. Testifying alongside her, Claire Shipman, the co-chair of Columbia's Board of Trustees, made the point bluntly. We have a moral crisis on our campus, she said. Republicans seemed skeptical, but Dr. Shafik's conciliatory tone offered the latest measure of how much universities have changed their approach toward campus protests over the last few months. Many schools were initially hesitant to take strong steps limiting freedom of expression cherished on their campuses. But with many Jewish students, faculty, and alumni raising alarms, and with the federal government investigating dozens of schools, some administrators have tried to take more assertive steps to control their campuses. With 5,000 Jewish students and an active protest movement for the Palestinian cause, Columbia has been among the most scrutinized. Jewish students have described being verbally and even physically harassed, while demonstrators have clashed with administrators over limits to where and when they can assemble. In bending toward House Republicans in Washington, Dr. Shafik may have further divided her New York City campus, where students had pitched tents and set up a Gaza Solidarity in Campus, that's in quotes, early on Wednesday. Colorado extends privacy rights to what goes on in our brains. Consumers have grown accustomed to the prospect that their personal data, such as email addresses, social contacts, browsing history, and genetic ancestry, are being collected and often resold by the apps and the digital services they use. With the advent of consumer neurotechnologies, the data being collected is becoming ever more intimate. One headband serves as a personal meditation coach by monitoring the user's brain activity. Another purports to help treat anxiety and symptoms of depression. Another reads and interprets brain signals while the user scrolls through dating apps, presumably to provide better matches. Listen to your heart is not enough, the manufacturer says on its website. The companies behind such technologies have access to the records of the user's brain activity, the electrical signals underlying our thoughts, feelings, and intentions. On Wednesday, Governor Jared Polis of Colorado signed a bill that, for the first time in the United States, tries to ensure that such data remains truly private. The new law, which passed by a 61-1 vote in the Colorado House and a 34-0 vote in the Senate, expands the definition of sensitive data, that's in quotes, in the state's current personal privacy law to include biological and neural data generated by the brain, the spinal cord, and the network of nerves that relays messages throughout the body. Everything that we are is within our mind, said Jared Genser, general counsel and co-founder of the Neuro Rights Foundation, a science group that advocated the bill's passage. What we think and feel, and the ability to decode that from the human brain, couldn't be any more intrusive or personal to us. We are really excited to have an actual bill signed into law that will protect people's biological and neurological data, said Representative Kathy Kipp, a Democrat who introduced the bill. Senator Mark Baisley, a Republican who sponsored the bill in the upper chamber, said, "I'm feeling really good about Colorado leading the way in addressing this and to give it the due protections for people's uniqueness in their privacy." Biden will deny mining road through Alaskan wilderness. The Biden administration is expected to deny permission for a 211-mile industrial road through fragile Alaskan wilderness to a large copper deposit, handing a victory to environmentalists in an election year when the president wants to underscore his credentials as a climate leader and conservationist. The Interior Department intends to announce as early as this week that there should be no action on the federal land where the road known as the Ambler Access Project would be built, according to two people familiar with the decision, who asked not to be named because they were not authorized to discuss the decision. A formal denial of the project would come later this year, they said. The road was essential to reach what is estimated to be a $7.5 billion copper deposit buried under ecologically sensitive land. There are currently no mines in the area, and no requests for permits have been filed with the government. The road was a first step. Blocking the industrial road would be an enormous victory for opponents who have argued for years that it would threaten wildlife as well as Alaska Native tribes that rely on hunting and fishing. Environmentalists, including many young climate activists, were infuriated last year by President Biden's decision to approve Willow, an $8 billion oil drilling project on pristine federal lands in Alaska. The proposed road would be several hundred miles south of the Willow Project. The move comes as the Biden administration tries to find a balance between two different and sometimes opposing goals. Mr. Biden is intent on bolstering clean energy in the United States to fight climate change. Ambler Metals, the mining venture behind the proposed road, has said the copper it seeks is critical to make wind turbines, photovoltaic cells, and transmission lines needed for wind, solar, and other renewable energy. But the president is also determined to conserve environmentally sensitive lands and has been expanding the footprint of national monuments around the country while also blocking off some public lands from oil and gas drilling. David Krause, the interim executive director of the National Audubon Society's Alaska office, said protecting the wilderness around the Ambler area is a huge deal. And now we'll have the national weather forecast before taking a brief break. So that national forecast for today, April 18th, storms will take shape in the central and southern plains today, spreading thunderstorms across much of the center of the country. Thunderstorms will be severe early on in Missouri and expand in coverage to stretch from Indiana to Texas. The main threats from the storms will be for large hail and damaging wind gusts. In the northeast, rain and drizzle will linger through the day, and temperatures will trend lower than previous days. Most of the west will remain largely dry, with the exception of showers in the higher elevations of the Rockies. It will be another cool day in the northern plains and northern Rockies, with temperatures remaining 5 to 10 degrees below average. Much of the southern United States will experience very warm conditions. And now we'll take a brief break, and we'll be back with more news from the business section of the New York Times.
For helpful tips on using assistive computer technology, listen Monday afternoons at 2 for the Keystrokes Computer Hour on Chris.
The forecast for this evening is mostly cloudy with a low around 40. Tomorrow looks to be partly sunny with a high near 59. Mostly cloudy tomorrow evening with a chance of showers, low around 46. Saturday looks to be partly sunny with a high near 66. Partly cloudy Saturday evening with a low around 39. And Sunday, mostly sunny with a high near 62. Partly cloudy Sunday evening with a low around 38. Have a great evening, and thanks for listening to Chris.
Now we'll have a few stories from the business section of the New York Times. Tesla's board stands firm with Musk on pay plan. Facing criticism that is overly beholden to Elon Musk, Tesla's board of directors said on Wednesday that it would essentially give him everything he wanted, including the biggest pay package in corporate history. If setbacks in court and the car market have induced any soul-searching among Tesla's board, there was no sign of it in the latest announcement. If anything, the board doubled down on backing Mr. Musk, Tesla's chief executive, risking riling up activist investors and more litigation. The board's decision to ask shareholders to endorse a compensation plan for Mr. Musk that is worth about $47 billion came less than 3 months after a Delaware judge voided the same 10-year pay package. The judge said that it was excessive and that the company had failed to properly disclose details about it to shareholders who approved it in 2018. Tesla will now provide shareholders more information about how the plan was devised and ask them to approve it again. That vote will take place as investors are increasingly worried about the electric car company because its sales are declining and its stock has fallen more than one-third this year. In addition, Mr. Musk has not presented much of a plan to restore the company's momentum. Greg Varallo, a lawyer who represented shareholders in the Delaware case, declined to comment Wednesday on steps his team might take. But the board's action is likely to prompt more lawsuits against the company, which is under legal pressure from regulators, customers, and people who say they have been victims of faults in Tesla drive assistance systems. AI David from Europe eyes Goliaths. Paris Mensch, tall and lean with a flop of unkempt hair, arrived for a speech last month at a sprawling tech hub in Paris, wearing jeans and carrying a bicycle helmet. He had an unassuming look for a person European officials are counting on to help propel the region into a high-stakes match with the United States and China over artificial intelligence. Mr. Mensch, 31, is the chief executive and a founder of Mistral, considered by many to be one of the most promising challengers to OpenAI and Google. "You have become the poster child for AI in France," Matt Clifford, a British investor, told him on stage. A lot is riding on Mr. Mensch, whose company has shot into the spotlight just a year after he founded it in Paris with two college friends. As Europe scrambles to get a foothold in the AI revolution, the French government has singled out Mistral as its best hope to create a standard bearer and has lobbied European Union policymakers to help ensure the firm's success. Artificial intelligence will be built rapidly into the global economy in the coming decade, and policymakers and business leaders in Europe fear that growth and competitiveness will suffer if the region does not keep up. Behind their worries is a conviction that AI should not be dominated by tech giants like Microsoft and Google that might forge global standards at odds with the culture and politics of other countries. At stake is the bigger question of which artificial intelligence models will wind up influencing the world and how they should be regulated. Voting tests unions' push at VW plant. Last fall, the United Automobile Workers Union won big pay increases from the Detroit automakers, and the impact rippled quickly through the non-union auto plants scattered across the South. Afterward, Toyota, Honda, Volkswagen, Nissan, Hyundai, and Tesla raised wages for their own hourly workers in the United States, none of whom are unionized. On production lines in Alabama, Tennessee, Kentucky, and elsewhere, those pay increases have been referred to as the UAW bump. Now, 4,300 workers at Volkswagen's plant in Chattanooga, Tennessee, will test whether the union can achieve an even greater bump. On Wednesday, they began voting on whether to join the UAW, United Auto Workers, and the prospects of a union victory appear high. About 70% of the workers pledged to vote yes before the union asked for a vote, according to the UAW. "I think our chances are excellent," said Kelsey Smith, who has worked in the VW plant's paint department for a year and is a member of a committee working to build support for the UAW. "The energy is high. I think we are going to nail it." Volkswagen has presented reasons it believes a union is not needed at the plant, including pay that is above average for the Chattanooga region. But it has also said it encourages all workers to vote in the election, which is to conclude on Friday, and decide for themselves. Trains, trucks, and tractors. A race to reroute goods from Baltimore. New John Deere tractors made their way last week through the sprawling port of Brunswick, Georgia, their distinctive green paint glinting in the sunshine. Stevedores drove the tractors up a ramp into the belly of the Leo Spirit, a ship that would take them to Asia. As orderly as everything looked, the tractor convoy was an example of the enormous lengths to which East Coast ports, railways, truckers, and shipping lines have gone to remake supply chains after a container ship crashed into the Francis Scott Key Bridge in Baltimore last month. The bridge's collapse closed most of the port of Baltimore, which last year handled 1.3 million tons of farm and construction machinery and 850,000 cars and light trucks. The Deere tractors would normally be shipped from Baltimore, getting there on trains from a factory in Waterloo, Iowa, according to Georgia port officials. Instead, the tractors had to be trucked to Brunswick, a journey that adds time and costs. If we didn't have Brunswick, I think the supply chain would be in a bad way on the auto side, said Griff Lynch, chief executive of the Georgia Ports Authority, who has overseen an ambitious expansion of Brunswick. But he said some areas at the port were now getting congested and acknowledged there was no way Brunswick could handle all of Baltimore's vehicles. In April, the port expects to take around 17,000 more than the 70,000 it normally handles in a month. Such frenetic workarounds to deal with Baltimore's closing are happening up and down the East Coast. And now we'll take a brief break, and we'll be back with more news, this time from the Hartford Courant.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Ackerman, a CRIS radio volunteer, with an invitation to join your friends at the Cheshire Lions Club's 66th Annual Dinner Dance for the Blind, to be held Monday, May 6th, 6 to 9:30 p.m. at the AquaTurf Club in Plantsville. This annual party is dedicated to those who have lost their sight and to all Lions who serve by helping in the fight against blindness. The cost is $40 per person, but there is no charge for visually impaired guests and their drivers when sponsored by the Cheshire Lions Club or one of the other area Lions clubs or businesses. For more information about the dance or to register your attendance, please call Lion Bill Manthe at 203-723-4821. That's Bill Manthe at 203-723-4821. Or by email at CheshireCTLionsClub@gmail.com. CheshireCTLionsClub@gmail.com. RSVPs need to be in by Monday, April 22nd, so call or email today.
Restaurant workers dealing with more sexual harassment. We are reading stories from the Hartford Courant today. Sexual harassment is a pervasive threat in the restaurant industry, impacting 7 out of every 10 female workers, according to research from advocacy groups. The Connecticut State Capitol is not a typical venue for a self-defense class, but on Wednesday, current and former restaurant staff partnered with an instructor from FITE, fit to raise awareness about the problem and send a message that we are not on the menu. And I'm sorry, I read that incorrectly. FITE, FIT, is the name of the organization. The demonstration was full of smiles and laughs, but it was inspired by a very serious issue. More than 70% of female restaurant workers have experienced sexual harassment on the job, according to research by One Fair Wage and the University of California, Berkeley Food Labor Research Center. Advocates say the problem is amplified by the existence of a sub-minimum wage, which they said forces staff to endure inappropriate behavior to get tips. According to the report, 76% of tipped workers reported experience with sexual harassment compared to 52% of their non-tipped colleagues. Grace McGovern, an organizer for One Fair Wage in Massachusetts and Connecticut, said that as a bartender in Boston, it is not uncommon to hear customers comment on her body or speculate about the number of romantic partners she has had. Especially in places where you're serving alcohol, you get into a rhythm of having regulars and knowing who's going to tip well. And if someone's known for tipping well, they can get away with being creepy, McGovern said. I have coworkers who are freshly 18 and 19, and the regulars are 60-year-old men, and they're saying disgusting things to these girls. In severe cases, the customer might be asked to leave. But usually it's just the employee who is asked to grin and bear it, McGovern added. While McGovern said that customers are often the main perpetrators of harassment in the restaurant industry, co-workers and management can cause problems too. Approximately 48% of the tipped workers surveyed in the report said they had been sexually harassed by a customer. Roughly 46% said they were harassed by a co-worker. McGovern described these experiences as infuriating. Ex-Chief Justice was law pioneer. Ellen Ash Peters, a former Chief Justice of the Connecticut Supreme Court and a groundbreaking figure among women in the law, has died, colleagues said Tuesday. She was 94. Peters was the first woman appointed to the Supreme Court, the first woman named Chief Justice, and before that was the first woman to gain tenure at Yale Law School. Peters wrote the majority opinion in the court's landmark 1996 Sheff versus O'Neill decision, which extended civil rights to the right to a public school education, holding that the state has an obligation to provide school children with equal educational opportunities. The court's conclusion that equal educational opportunity is a constitutionally guaranteed right set in motion decades of legal and legislative efforts to equalize learning among the state's distinct and often racially isolated school districts. It is with great sadness that I learned today that my predecessor, retired Chief Justice Ellen A. Peters, passed away, Chief Justice Richard A. Robinson said. I had the incredible honor of not only arguing before her at the Supreme Court, but to work beside her on the appellate court. Chief Justice Peters was the first woman to serve in Connecticut as a justice and chief justice, and what a trailblazer she was. While small in stature, she was a fearless legal giant who was dedicated to upholding the rule of law. She also recognized the importance of fairness, openness, transparency, and providing true equal access to justice for all. As such, she appointed a task force to determine the presence and extent of gender bias in Connecticut courts and to develop strategies for its eradication. In addition, Chief Justice Peters appointed a task force on minority fairness, charging it with identifying any discriminatory treatment of racial or ethnic minorities within the Connecticut judicial branch. These two reports have served as the basis for continuing progress in these two very important areas. Both her legacy and achievements will guide generations of lawyers, judges, and law students for many years to come. Peters was appointed to the state's high court in 1978 by then-Governor Ella T. Grasso, the nation's first female governor. Peters was named Chief Justice by then-Governor William A. O'Neill in 1984. Lawmakers eye street takeover crackdown. With the spread of street takeovers, state lawmakers took steps Wednesday to help local officials regain control of their streets. The state House of Representatives voted 148-0, with three members absent, for the bipartisan measure to control takeovers that have proved to be a headache for mayors, first selectmen, and police. The tools for the towns include allowing municipalities to create ordinances on takeovers, increased penalties for those involved, and allowing forfeiture of certain vehicles that were used illegally. After vehicles are confiscated by the police, the municipalities will be given new authority to destroy dirt bikes, mini motorcycles, and all-terrain vehicles after holding them for a minimum of 30 days. If the police department is holding the vehicle and they want to destroy it after 30 days, they can, said Representative Steven Strafstrom, a Bridgeport Democrat who co-chairs the legislature's Judiciary Committee. Street takeovers are defined under state law as, quote, blocking or impeding the regular flow of traffic, end quote, with motor vehicles on public highways or parking areas with the intent to cause disorder or nuisance. They have occurred in Milford, Meriden, Tolland, West Haven, North Haven, and other communities. For decades, drag racing and street racing have been problematic in isolated areas. The difference now, police said, is that large crowds gather to watch events that have been promoted through social media. In some instances, the cars block intersections and prevent other drivers from getting through. Representative Gail Mastrofrancesco, a conservative Republican from Walcott, said the violators should be punished. Street takeovers are very bad, and these people should be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law, Mastrofrancesco said. Representative Joe Paletta, a Watertown Republican, said police have been baffled by the occurrences. Part of my district is Waterbury, and we are no stranger to street takeovers, Paletta said. One was a violent street takeover on May 7th of last year. The perpetrator was arrested and his bond was set at $25,000, and then it was lowered to a promise to appear. That's a problem across the state of Connecticut. Johnson's push on aid gets support from President. President Joe Biden said Wednesday that he strongly supports a proposal from Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson to provide aid to Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan, sending crucial bipartisan support to the effort this week to approve $95 billion in funding for the U.S. allies. Ahead of potential weekend voting, Johnson was facing a choice between losing his job and funding Ukraine. He notified lawmakers earlier Wednesday that he would forge ahead despite growing anger from his right flank. Shortly after Johnson released the funding proposals, Biden offered his emphatic support for the program. The House must pass the package this week, and the Senate should quickly follow, the Democratic president said. I will sign this into law immediately to send a message to the world. We stand with our friends, and we won't let Iran or Russia succeed. After agonizing over how to proceed on the package for days, Johnson notified GOP lawmakers Wednesday that he would push to hold votes on three funding packages for Ukraine, Israel, and allies in the Indo-Pacific, as well as several other foreign policy proposals in a fourth bill. The plan roughly matches the amounts that the Senate has already approved. A strong America is good for the entire world, Johnson told reporters. He asserted he had taken the Senate bill and improved the process and policy. Johnson emphasized that the bulk of the funding for Ukraine would go to purchasing weapons and ammunition from U.S. defense manufacturers. The legislation proposes that $9 billion of economic assistance for Kyiv be structured as forgivable loans, along with greater oversight on military funding. But the decision to support Ukraine at all has angered populist conservatives in the House and given new energy to a threat to remove him from the Speaker's office. The votes on the package are expected Saturday evening, Johnson said. But he faces a treacherous path to get there. The Speaker needs Democratic support on the procedural maneuvers to advance his complex plan of holding separate votes on each part of the aid package. Johnson is trying to squeeze the aid through the House's political divisions on foreign policy by forming unique voting blocks for each issue and then sewing the package back together. And this segment of reading from the New York Times, we're on the Hartford Current now. We'll be back with news from the Connecticut section of the Hartford Current after a brief break.
Windsor's Connecticut Valley Tobacco Museum, with the help of the Windsor Lions Club and Chris Radio, has set up 18 Chris Access readers describing various exhibits for low vision and print disabled individuals. With input from the low vision population, and working with a teacher of low vision and print disabled individuals, we have also improved the accessibility of these readers with highly visible markers on the floor. To access the QR code, just open the camera option on your phone, scan the QR code, and press enter once the link is shown. Please be aware that cell phone coverage in Northwest Park, where the Tobacco Museum is located, is limited. So please stop by the archive building to get the Wi-Fi password. If you or someone you know are interested in using this unique feature,
please call the Tobacco Museum at 860-285-1888 or email windsorconnecticutmuseum@gmail.com. The Connecticut Valley Tobacco Museum is located in Windsor's Northwest Park, 135 Lang Road, and is open Fridays and Saturdays, noon to 4 p.m. through the last week of October. And we're back with more news from today's Hartford Current. Sikorsky confirms layoffs coming. Sikorsky Aircraft will lay off an unspecified number of workers following the U.S. Army's announcement that it will not build a new attack reconnaissance aircraft, a spokesperson for Lockheed Martin confirmed. As a result of the U.S. Army's recent decision to cancel the Future Attack Reconnaissance Aircraft, FARA, program, we are reducing positions within our Sikorsky business segment, which amounts to less than 1% of the Lockheed Martin workforce, the spokesperson said. We intend to retain as many roles as possible to meet national security commitments and preserve the U.S. rotary wing industrial base. The company did not provide an exact number of workers impacted. Lockheed Martin employs 122,000 people worldwide. The Stratford-based company, as well as Connecticut's congressional delegation, had in February expressed disappointment that the Army abandoned the search for a manufacturer to build the new Future Attack reconnaissance aircraft. The program began in 2018, and Sikorsky was selected as a finalist for its Raider X prototype, competing once again against Bell Textron, CT Mirror reported. Sikorsky employs thousands of people in the state between its Stratford headquarters and other campuses. Hundreds of businesses are suppliers to the Lockheed Martin-owned company, the Mirror reported. We are extremely disappointed that the Army has decided to walk away from the FARA program. We have been told on multiple occasions by the Army that FARA was their number one priority. This is a complete reversal of that position, the Connecticut Congressional delegation said in a February statement. Sikorsky has the world's greatest workforce when it comes to vertical lift aircraft and decades of proven results when it comes to supplying the U.S. armed forces and militaries across the globe with safe, dependable military and commercial aircraft. We demand that the Army provide us with a detailed explanation of how they plan to achieve crucial aviation capabilities, thoughtfully prepare our national defense for the future, and utilize the exceptional and seasoned workforce at Sikorsky for generations to come. U.S. Representative Rosa DeLauro, a Democrat from District 3, had an immediate response of disappointment about the Connecticut layoffs. People from across DeLauro's district work at Sikorsky. I believe that keeping good, highly skilled manufacturing jobs in Connecticut is essential, and it has been a top priority of mine throughout my career, DeLauro said in an email. I have spoken with Sikorsky leadership to discuss their plans and the ways we can work together to keep jobs in Connecticut. Middle school teacher arrested. A Manchester middle school teacher was arrested Tuesday on child endangerment charges for allegedly touching several of his students inappropriately. Floyd Gray, 58, of Hartford, turned himself in to police on three counts each, risk of injury to a minor, and second-degree breach of peace, according to Lieutenant Nick Reinert of the Manchester Police Department. In February, police received complaints from three students at Illing Middle School, where Gray works as their teacher, alleging that he touched them inappropriately and made inappropriate comments while in class, according to Reinert. Reinert noted that although the students were not in the same class, the incidents they reported were all similar. Upon receiving the complaint, the Manchester Police Department, the Manchester Public School Administration, and the Connecticut Department of Children and Families initiated investigations, Reinert said. Police investigators later obtained a warrant for Gray's arrest. Manchester Superintendent of Schools Matt Geary sent a letter to the school community on Tuesday upon learning of the arrest. In February, three students reported their concerns to school administration, Geary wrote. The students indicated that the teacher made them uncomfortable with inappropriate comments and by touching, rubbing their shoulders while in class. According to Geary, school officials immediately notified police and DCF and placed Gray on leave. He was still on leave as of Tuesday, Geary said. Hartford considers a party bike proposal. Hartford City Council members are considering bringing a pedal pub to the city. The vehicles, sometimes known as beer bikes or party bikes, are already popular in the South in several cities like Austin, Miami, and Charlotte. Pedal pubs, which act as a cross between a mobile bar and a street trolley, are manually controlled by up to 15 riders who sit facing a central bar area and pedal with their legs, much like on a bicycle. The idea is riders can drink, eat, listen to music, and take in the scenery, all while getting a little exercise. Under Connecticut law, bicyclists cannot drink while operating, much like driving a vehicle under the influence. But pedal pubs are manually steered by a trained driver who remains sober to ensure they are street legal. The vehicles also come with electric assists to make it a little easier for riders and to allow the pedal pub to move quickly in case of oncoming emergency vehicles. Pedal pub bikes are equipped with headlights, brake lights, tail lights, blinkers, brakes, and emergency brakes. The vehicles also come with 5 cheerleading seats, and that's in quotes, where passengers who grow tired can rest and not have to pedal while enjoying their drinks. Councilwoman Mally Rosato introduced the resolution for a pedal pub after she talked with local leaders about the success New Haven has had with its Elm City party bike. The resolution has now been referred to the Operations Management Budget and Government Accountability Committee for review before any council vote. The City of New Haven has seen the successful implementation of a pedal pub, an innovative and eco-friendly mode of transportation and entertainment, and has been well received by both residents and visitors from its promotion of local businesses, according to the resolution drafted by Rosato. Pedal Pub, a franchise which operates in over 50 cities in the U.S. and Canada, markets the vehicles as an eco-friendly way to drive tourism and resident engagement while providing revenue to small businesses. The vehicle tours last around 2 hours and make stops along a dedicated route in a city's downtown area. Pedal Pub recommends each franchise owner to purchase and operate 2 bikes, according to its website. Our last article today. Sports Foundation puts kids across the state on the field. When Christian Vick talks about what the James Vick Foundation has accomplished in the past 6 years, he exudes excitement, passion for his work, and most of all, faith in what girls can accomplish in sports. The excitement is natural, as there is competition involved. The passion shows in the hours and financial support Vick puts into the foundation. The faith has been proven in the games played and wins seen by foundation-sponsored field hockey and lacrosse teams. It's a kid-driven organization, Vic said. They drive everything. The foundation, first organized in 2018 and named for Vic's father, focuses on providing sports experiences in an accessible way through club teams, leagues, clinics, and more, Vic said. During the pandemic, that meant, for example, the foundation organizing a 2020 lacrosse tournament for girls so they could play safely and not have to give up an entire season, Vic said. It was an organizational feat that Vic still recounts with a little bit of awe, considering the politicians and medical personnel involved. Perhaps not unexpectedly, Vic counts Ann Worcester of New Haven's former Connecticut Open tennis tournament fame as his inspiration. The overall goal of the foundation, according to Vic, is not just to organize one game or one tournament, but to be a resource by including scholarships for athletes who might not otherwise have the opportunity to play due to expenses. An example, he said, could be an athlete with multiple siblings who all want to play sports. The foundation supplies coaches and even provides uniforms. What we really seek out are families and kids that need the opportunity. Everybody is there for a reason, Vic said. We're proving that if sports is accessible, then the play is equal. Now the foundation is preparing for its biggest event yet, the 2024 Yale Series Championship, starting on Sunday and concluding with a single elimination championship tournament on May 19th, Vic said. It will be played on Yale's Johnson Field, he said. Teams from all over the country are coming to play. We have a massive opportunity. Yale extended the opportunity. Our team, the girls aren't paying any fees for the tournament, he added. And that ends our news portion of today's program. But we do have a few more other items. Some birthdays, first of all, for today, April 18th. Actor Haley Mills is 78. Actor James Woods is 77. Actor Rick Moranis is 71. Actor Eric Roberts is 68. Author-journalist Susan Faludi is 65. Actor Jane Leaves is 63. Talk show host Conan O'Brien is 61. Actor Eric McCormick is 61. Actor Maria Bello is 57. Let me see. Actor David Tennant is 53. Actor Melissa Joan Hart is 48. Reality TV star Kourtney Kardashian is 45. Detroit Tigers first baseman and designated hitter Miguel Cabrera is 41. Actor America Ferreira is 40. And actor Vanessa Kirby is 36. Finally, some almanac items. Today is Thursday, April 18th, the 109th day of 2024. There are 257 days left in the year. Today's highlight in history, on April 18th, 1906, a devastating earthquake struck San Francisco, followed by raging fires. Estimates of the final death toll range between 3,000 and 6,000. Also on this date, a few more items. In 1775, Paul Revere began his famous ride from Charlestown to Lexington, Massachusetts, warning colonists that British regular troops were approaching. In 2023, the first game was played at the original Yankee Stadium in New York. The Yankees defeated the Boston Red Sox 4-1. In 1954, Gamal Abdel Nasser seized power as he became Prime Minister of Egypt. In 1966, Bill Russell was named player coach of the Boston Celtics, becoming the NBA's first black coach. In 1978, the Senate approved the Panama Canal Treaty, providing for the complete turnover of control of the waterway to Panama on the last day of 1999. In 2012, Dick Clark, the ever-youthful television host and producer who helped bring rock and roll into the mainstream on American Bandstand and ring in the new year for the masses at Times Square, died at age 82. In 2016, Hamilton, Lin-Manuel Miranda's hip-hop stage biography of America's first Treasury Secretary, won the Pulitzer Prize for Drama. And finally, in 2022, Russia launched a long-feared full-scale offensive to take control of Ukraine's east, the country's mostly Russian-speaking industrial heartland, where Moscow-backed separatists had been fighting Ukrainian forces for 8 years. And that's all for this edition of the Front Pages. I've been reading from today's New York Times and Hartford Current. My name is Lodia Vola. If you missed any part of the program, it is repeated this evening at 6 and 11, and it's available anytime on our television reader service and on demand at our website, chrisradio.org. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
Serving Connecticut with newspaper and magazine readings for more than 30 years, we are CHRIS, the Connecticut Radio Information System.
Welcome to the Shopper's Guide. For the next 30 minutes, we'll take a look at the most recent sales flyers from various stores.